So here we continue then. So for those of you coming from a Zen background, we're right in the midst of this practice of settling the mind in its natural state, which is very Zen-ish, that it's just really in the mood of Zen so much. I don't know that this practice as such is found in the Zen tradition, but it certainly resonates a lot with the Chan and the Zen tradition, settling the mind in its natural state. And so I want to come back because some people find it a bit inaccessible, a bit elusive, hard to kind of tie down. And for a very good reason, the whole idea in this practice is not to tie anything down, right? The core, if you memorize any one aphorism, that it provides the quintessential instruction for this whole practice. In Tibetan, it's ma yeng zi me. Ma yeng means not distracted. Zi me means no grasping. Not distracted, no grasping. Hai. So, but that's the essence of it. You're resting right in the nature of awareness without being carried away and without grasping on anything. But of course, it's not just an open awareness, you know, come one, come all. It is selective. It is focused on the space of the mind or whatever arises in it. But let's get really familiar with this nucleus of the practice that in a way we're already familiar with because I made it quite explicit. When we were practicing last week, we focused on mindfulness of breathing. And I made a point then, which I've not always emphasized over the years, but I'm emphasizing more and more now, that even while practicing mindfulness of breathing, where you clearly have a target, an object to fasten your attention to, even there, very useful to have that sense of your awareness resting in its own place, illuminating your target, the object of mindfulness, but without slipping off your throne, without getting caught up, entangled, grasping into it, identifying with it, and so forth and so on. Just illuminating it, right? So we had that experience of just resting, and then directing the attention to our chosen object, right? So let's just do this for a few seconds. You don't need to move. You don't need a special posture or even move your hands. You don't need to do that. Just right where you are. This is so simple, and we're going to do it only for a matter of a few seconds. Just let your awareness rest right where it is. And without directing it anywhere to any object, inside or outside. Simply be present. Not withdrawing from any object, but not going out to any object. Really not doing anything at all except for being present, being aware. In stillness, still because your awareness temporarily, for these few seconds, is free of grasping. Where there's grasping, there's movement. Where there's no grasping, there is stillness. The very nature of awareness is knowing. So for just a few more seconds, just rest in that knowing, that awareness of knowing, that awareness of being aware. Okay, that's enough for now. So that awareness, ever so simple, awareness that was already there, that is, we weren't doing something fresh, we weren't, to do that very simple exercise, really for a matter of just a few seconds, we weren't doing something more. We're doing a lot less. Because right now, you're aware of being aware. Right? But you're also aware of my talking. Hand gestures, tone of voice, etc. You're aware of your body, the environment. Maybe you're aware now of the sound of the air conditioning. Oh, there it is. And so we cloak that awareness. We adorn it with many add-ons. We can add on, almost like putting on clothing. So we can put on a nice big woolen cloak of mindfulness of breathing, And so we take that naked awareness, that just raw awareness of just being aware, said, I'm still aware of being aware, but now I'm aware of my breath too. So that's a cloak, right? Something added on. You weren't doing that before, but now you're doing it. Oh, let's do this. Let's do practice mindfulness of breathing. Let's do that now. We weren't doing it before, but then we do it, right? So it's something we put on, right? So, okay, now let's not do that anymore. Now let's attend to this, to the space of the mind and its contents. So we cloak it instead of a wool cloak. Okay, just a silken garment. Just one silk garment. Just space of the mind, whatever arises. Quite light. Maybe say, I'm too hot. I want to take off that cloak. I want to strip down naked. Then you just go to awareness of awareness. And it was already there. This is a process of subtraction, not a process of addition. Right? So that's quite important. We're adding all the time. I'm attending to Linda, I'm attending to Aga, attending to Scott. So I'm adding, attending to everybody on the left side of the room, my left hemisphere. Everybody on the right side of the room, adding. But this is a process of subtraction, right? So what I'm getting at here, I think, is something quite interesting and important. And that is when we just kind of strip down naked and rest there at least for a little while, what we're resting in is awareness. And the Tibetan word for awareness is rigpa. The Sanskrit word for it is vidya. And we're not going cosmic here. We're not going to pristine awareness, primordial consciousness, dzogchen. Just the ordinary term in Buddhist psychology for knowing, for being aware. Just that. I'm aware of Paolo. Okay, that's not you know, transcending all space and time and going to primordial consciousness. I'm just aware there's Paolo. Gotcha. That's awareness. That's rigpa, right? So I'm aware of Paolo. I know he's there, right? So this term has a very ordinary connotation to it. Yes, I'm aware of Paolo. I'm aware of my hands. Hello, hands. Hello. I'm aware of you. Hello. You know, that's it. Awareness. And so we're just resting in awareness, and we're aware of awareness. But as we do that for a few seconds, after some time, something slips. We're carried away into rumination, or Sanskrit vikalpa, obsessive, compulsive, delusional thinking. We're carried away. And so we're all familiar with that. Mindfulness of breathing, we practice, and then suddenly we're carried away. And then some seconds later, oh-ho, my mind's wandering, come back, relax, release, return, gotcha, okay, back we go. Likewise, settling the mind, observing whatever's arising right there in the space of the mind, and then whoop, gone. Uh-oh, retrospectively, relax, release, return, okay, back we are. So we keep on losing awareness. So there's that shift from rigpa, from being aware, to not being so aware, not blacking out. But something veiled, something, we all know what it's like. I don't need to describe what it's like because you know it, right? What it's like to be aware and then not. Where you're caught up kind of aware, but not really, because you don't even know you're thinking. In rumination, in a wander, when the mind gets caught up in wandering, you're not blacked out, of course, but you're not aware that your mind is wandering. It's not a voluntary act. It catches you unaware. So there's a slip there from awareness to a non-awareness of what's going on, because in fact you're drifting off into some rumination or vikalpa, and you're not even aware of it, right? And then you catch yourself. So that right there is quite an interesting process. For those of you who studied Buddhism, you'll hear this phrase a lot. You're very familiar with it. Samsara has no beginning, right? But it does have an end. So that's good news. But it has no beginning, but it does have an end, right? When we go to the 12 links of dependent origination, which shows kind of the mechanics of samsara, how this wheel perpetuates itself in an ongoing cycle that never ends. It's a perpetual motion machine. It's called samsara. The very first link is not rigpa, not awareness, ma rigpa, avidya. Ah is like just a negation, like amoral, not moral, amoral. Avidya is not vidya. Ma rigpa is not rigpa. So the very first link there that sets the whole sequence in motion, the ongoing spinning of samsara, the cycle of existence, is not knowing, unawareness. Now, there's a very interesting principle in Buddhism, and I find it in quantum mechanics as well. The principle is this, that we define something as being existent. We define just the category of something being existent, right? If it's knowable. Knowable. If something is not knowable, then we don't attribute it with the notion of existence. If it's not knowable, right? Now, maybe not known. I don't know how many hairs are on my head right now, but that doesn't mean there's not a certain number of hairs. It could be found out if one were really keenly interested, right? So it's knowable. I think I have a volunteer. No? Okay. Busy, busy, busy. But it's knowable, right? And so there are many things that we don't know, but they're knowable. But there may be some things that are unknowable. And I'll just slip to a very brief reference to quantum mechanics, which I found fascinating. It's from Werner Heisenberg. And he said, and he's speaking as one of the great pioneers of quantum mechanics, and he said, and I quote him, "Let us not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle. Let us not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle." Now, can you know whether something is unknowable in principle? And in quantum mechanics, they say, well, yes, you can, as a matter of fact. What's the state of a quantum system before you measure it? What's actually there? Here and there and there and there, and so forth. What's there before you make the measurement? And Werner Heisenberg, speaking really for the great majority of people working in the field of quantum mechanics, said, well, that is unknowable in principle. The only way you can know is by making a measurement. But prior to the measurement, what's there? You can't say it. It's in a superposition state. It's only a state of probability, of possibility. But you can't say this distinctly is here and that's distinctly there. That arises relative to the act of measurement. And so what is there prior to the measurement is unknowable in principle, and therefore don't attribute existence to it. Right? Well, it's the same thing in Buddhism. If something is unknowable in principle, then you don't attribute existence to it. So come back to the first of the 12 links of dependent origination, unknowing. Come back to the first moment when you're hanging out there, let's say practicing mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind, whatever. And then you lose it. There you were, you're resting in rikpa, you're resting in knowing, right? And then a little while, you're not. You've gone off someplace. When exactly did that happen? I mean, to the precise instant. When exactly did that wandering thought begin? If you knew, it wouldn't be a wandering thought. It would be a conscious act like, you ready? Mary had a little lamb whose fleece was white as snow. That was a deliberate thought. I was there from the very beginning. You know, and I'm thinking that, the same thing. I'm right there. I'm getting it from the very beginning. So that's not a wandering thought. That's a deliberate thought. But where we just get caught up and carried away involuntarily and compulsively drawn into the thought. The first moment of that, when did it first happen? Well, if you knew, it wouldn't have happened. If that's true, then the first moment of a wandering thought is unknowable in principle. Because if you knew it, it wouldn't be a wandering thought. It wouldn't be vikalpa. It wouldn't be this obsessive, compulsive flow of ideation. It would be deliberate, conscious thought, which is fine, right? So is it interesting that that's a little kind of microcosm of samsara? You're resting in rikpa, not ultimate, cosmic, or anything like that. You're just resting in knowing, like right now, and then you're not. But that first moment of not, you don't know when it happened, because if you did, it wouldn't be not, it would be yep. It would be a continuation, a continuity of being aware, being aware, being aware, being aware. But then we're not. But when it happened, you don't know. If it's unknowable in principle, it had no beginning. Do not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle. Does the beginning of a wandering thought have any beginning? Is there a beginning to a wandering thought if it's unknowable in principle? Or is it beginningless? But then we know it has an end because we snap to, introspect and recognize, oh, the last three or four whatever seconds, I'm not quite sure, I was wandering. But I am no longer. I was bound, but now I'm free. So a little microcosm. A little microcosm of not knowing, and then insofar as that delusional aspect kicks in, is not only not knowing, but it's getting delusional, right? Because I'm mistaking my thoughts for the referent of the thought. I'm not recognizing the thought as a thought. I'm thinking that this is really reality, right? So a little microcosm of samsara, rooted in ignorance, caught up in delusion, with no beginning, but it has to have an end. Nice little microcosm, right? Very familiar. Now let's go to the mini-cosm. Microcosm is a tiny, tiny one. Mini-cosm, mid-range, right? Have you ever had a non-lucid dream? You're dreaming, but you don't know you're dreaming? When exactly did it begin? What was the very first instant? If you knew that, it wouldn't be a non-lucid dream. It would be a lucid dream. You'd know that that's a dream image, which means you would enter in lucidly, and then you could either maintain your lucidity or not. But the very fact that it's a non-lucid dream means when it first started, you weren't aware that the dream was starting. Because again, it's just the language itself indicates if you knew the dream was starting, it's not a non-lucid dream. Therefore, whether from within the context of a non-lucid dream, where you're just kind of dreaming along, can you ever remember exactly when it started? Or even when you wake up, or maybe even become lucid, can you even from that perspective remember when the non-lucid dream began? If you could, then you knew that it was a dream from the beginning, but then it wouldn't be non-lucid. So non-lucid dreams, if the beginning is unknowable in principle, a non-lucid dream has no beginning. Don't attribute existence to it if it's unknowable in principle. But we know that non-lucid dreams have an end. We can either become lucid within the dream or we can wake up. But they have an end one way or another, right? And then we have the macrocosm. It's called our lives. When did samsara begin? Well, if it began with marikpa, not awareness, as the first of the 12 links of intermediate origination, if for samsara to be launched, this is the big show, you know, samsara, rebirth, karma, the whole shebang. If we are aware of its beginning, then it wouldn't begin. Because the first of the 12 links wouldn't be there. It would be rikpa instead of marikpa. But because it's marikpa, we're not aware that when it began, because we weren't aware. And therefore the beginning of samsara may be unknowable in principle. Because if you knew it, it wouldn't be samsara. So a conclusion, because I'm also eager to get back to the practice. It said in the Mahayana tradition, remember I gave the analogy just this morning of being awake, just ordinary, you're awake. And then you see somebody lying in bed and they're groaning and they're moaning and they're struggling around and look like they're having a really bad dream. And you'd really like to help them, they're suffering. And you know they're suffering needlessly because they're suffering because of the dream, and the dream doesn't even exist from your perspective. It's just a fantasy. It's just nothing. It's empty appearances. And yet they're suffering. And the suffering is as real as anything they know, right? When we're suffering, what's more real than that? So you're witnessing this person obviously having a terrible nightmare, and you really want to help. Let's imagine you're not only awake, but you've got this really cool psychic ability to project yourself right into the person's dream. If you do so, you are aware of the moment you arrive in that dream because you did it consciously. And so you enter into that dream, but you're lucid from the very moment. You're aware, oh, this is this person's dream, right? So there's no marikpa, there's no avidya because you did it with compassion, with a motivation. You projected your awareness into that person's dream. From the very moment you're there, you're already aware, right? So there's no samsara for you. You're not dreaming. You're witnessing a dream, and you're there to help. So, you're a tulku. You come back out of compassion. You're not thrown by karma. You're not coming in with not knowing. You're thrown by compassion, and you're coming in with knowing, and you're coming there to awaken others. Right? unlike everybody else who's just thrown from one to the next to the next, coming in, not knowing, and then immediately getting deluded, misconstruing everything, and then suffering needlessly. So I think one can get some intimation, some intuition, some kind of heartfelt sense. No wonder that the thing that the Buddhas want for us most is just to wake up. Not to have a better dream. I mean, a better dream is certainly better than a nightmare. That would be nice. But if you wake up, then the problem really is solved. So above all, wake up. So there it is. So let's go back to settling the mind in its natural state. That was rather a long preamble, but hopefully not a waste of time. Let's go back to settling the mind in its natural state. So please find a comfortable position. I'll front load it just a little bit so I can speak less during the meditation. A central theme here as we're venturing into the practice, again, is to know from our own experience, the taste, the immediate experience of distinguishing between the stillness of your awareness, like an unflickering candle, just resting still and bright and clear and cognizant, the stillness of your own awareness, and distinguishing between that and the movement of thoughts, images, and so forth, to make that clear distinction. But I'll make one more point, and that is, while on the one hand the practice is for awareness not to merge with, dissolve in, become cognitively fused with the thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth, because then you're off, you know, daydreaming. So not cognitively fused, not lost in, not merged in the object. But the practice also is not to reaffirm or to fortify a strong dichotomy between my awareness over here, which is still, and then the thoughts, images, and so forth, the movements of the mind over there, which are in motion, some kind of a strong duality. It's not that either. It's something neither this nor that. It's neither simply getting lost in and carried away and merged with, nor is it total kind of a ripping of the fabric of the mind into two pieces. That is, my awareness being way over here and the thoughts being way over there. I'll end with this metaphor, because it's really not the case that awareness is separate, that is isolated, entirely, how do you say, inherently different from that which is illuminating. But this might be, I think it's, well, it's a good analogy. Imagine that the space of your mind, that three-dimensional vacuity, imagine that that space, which has no center and no periphery, just open. Imagine that that space is by nature illuminating. It's an illuminating space. So anything that appears in it just gets illuminated. The term that comes up a lot in Dzogchen literature is rang nang, and that is the phenomenon, whatever it is, it illuminates itself. It's just, there it is. Not from some external source, like a projector illuminating a screen over yonder, but just within this open vacuity of the space of the mind, something comes up, and it's rang nang. Rang means itself, and nang means illuminated, made manifest, appearing. So it's just, not from outside, but being in this field that is brimming over with luminosity, as soon as it's there, it's just there. It's just manifest. Something like that. Rang shar, it manifests, it arises of itself. Just, there it is. You know what it's like. Just some adventitious thought, a memory, an image. Just, there it is. Interesting. Just like out of the blue. Just out of the space of the mind. There it is. But it's also manifest, and it's rang nang. It's just illuminating itself. And how does that happen? Because it's arising in a space that is not a dead vacuity, not a simple void, a mere emptiness, but a vacuity that is by nature luminous, because that vacuity is saturated by the light of consciousness. But not again from something outside, but something non-dual. Something like that. Let's see if we can get the taste of it. That was a lot of words. Now let's just jump in. I'd like for you to have a Pavlovian response to the bell. As soon as you hear it, your shoulders relax, your face relaxes, your whole body responds by settling in a posture of ease, of comfort, of relaxation. As your body settles in this dynamic equipoise of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance, the complete surrender of all control over the breath. The breath naturally settles in its own rhythm. And then with a release, complete release or letting go of all grasping to the future and the past, a release of all grasping to any objects in the present. Let your awareness settle in stillness in its own place, neither inside nor outside, resting where it already is. Rest in that flow of knowing. Get familiar with it. Know it. So you know when you've lost it. And you know when you've regained it. Let the light of your awareness now suffuse or permeate the whole space of your body. Within that space, let your awareness illuminate or make manifest sensations arising that are representative of the earth, the water, fire, and air elements. And simply be present with them, mindfully attentive, without getting caught up in them, identifying with them, preferring them, just knowing them. These sensations that arise within the space of the body. be aware of the space of the body, as well as any tactile sensations that arise and pass within that space, and simply observe their nature without identifying with them, without preferring them, without reacting, conceptualizing, labeling them. Just be aware. As the Buddha said, in the somatically perceived, let there be just the somatically perceived. You can identify the domain of the space of the body, the tactile space, because that's where tactile sensations arise. It's just that simple. Note carefully, does the space of the body have clear contours, a clear edge, border? Let the object of mindfulness be the space of the body, or the tactile space, and whatever arises within that space. And as you attend to it, sustain the flow of mindfulness without distraction and without grasping. Honor to the flow of mindfulness with introspection, recognizing excitation and laxity, and apply the remedies as before. Now let your eyes be at least a little bit open. But rather than focusing your attention on any visual object, just rest your awareness in this space in front of you. This lets the light in. It helps to overcome laxity and dullness. Having the eyes open also helps to ground the awareness in the present moment, not so prone to getting caught up and carried away by rumination. And finally, having the eyes at least partially open also makes explicit the fact that the space of the mind is not behind your eyelids. It's not limited to being inside your head. It's open, it's spacious. So we don't reinforce the delusional notion that the mind is somehow inside the head and the space of the mind is behind your eyelids. Banish the thought. And now, as you previously attended to the space of the body and whatever tactile sensations arose within that space, apply that same quality of mindfulness to the space or domain of the mind and whatever mental events arise within that. Your body be still like a mountain, and your awareness still like space. And it is the space that illuminates whatever phenomena arise within that space. Again, in the early phases of this practice, if you find it helpful to give yourself a target within the space of the mind, deliberately generate a discursive thought or an image, focus on it single-pointedly, allow it to dissolve back into the space of the mind, and keep your attention right where it was, ready to observe the next thought or image that arises of its own accord, and simply observe its nature, letting it be. recognize when you're resting in awareness and when you're carried away by unawareness. By releasing all grasping, you'll not be carried away. Oh, Lasso. So this is a good question. It's a big one, but I'll start with the question and then a few comments. It's now not quite 5:30, so hopefully be able to finish off this one line. Once stability is achieved, let the mystery be revealed. It's quite a loaded line, but a question from Nicola, and that is, if you achieve shamatha in this lifetime, do the qualities of mind, such as mental balance, luminosity, pliancy, and so on, do these flow through unimpeded to your next life, or does the configuration of a new coarse mind obscure it in any way? Really good question. Really good news is that if one achieves shamatha in this life, first of all, the Dalai Lama was asked, if you fully achieve shamatha, you really get that deep, deep stability. What are the chances of losing it in this life? The Dalai Lama was asked that in one of the minor life meetings. And he said, very slim. If you've got it, you probably got it for life. That's good news. Brain damage, automobile accident, something like that, that could really throw things off. But barring some major mishap, there's just no reason to lose it. And then for my Lama Gyatso Rinpoche, for whom I've learned almost everything I know about Dzogchen, I asked him this question, and that is, we know that when you achieve shamatha, your mind dissolves into the substrate consciousness. The coarse mind is dissolved. Of course, it will come out again. But that substrate consciousness into which you dissolve, you know, it is exactly the same substrate consciousness in which your coarse mind dissolves when you come to the culmination of the dying process. Same place. Right? Most people die non-lucidly, just like most people fall asleep non-lucidly. And by the way, also, when was the, in terms of non-lucid dreamless sleep, when was the first moment you fell asleep? When exactly did that occur? And it's the same issue. If you knew when it was, then you would be falling asleep lucidly, which is a possibility. But if you're falling into non-lucid sleep, then the first moment, you don't know it because it's non-lucid. So once again, it looks like there's no first moment of falling deep asleep into non-lucid sleep. So most people fall asleep non-lucidly. Most people die non-lucidly. But if one achieves shamatha in this lifetime, then the chances are very, very good that you can die lucidly. Just be cognizant all the way through as you're watching the whole mind just basically evaporate. Your senses implode, the mind simplifying, and the mind dissolving right into the substrate consciousness. You have a very good chance of dying lucidly. Now, if you had a sudden death, like on a motorcycle, and then bam, you're dead really quickly, that'd be hard. So if you've achieved shamatha, just stay off motorcycles. That's why I sold mine. Didn't want one of those really quick deaths you couldn't enjoy, you know, really experience it. If you enter into the substrate consciousness lucidly in the dying process, so then you are dead lucidly, dead and knowing it, rather than simply being dead and blacked out, which is the way it's commonly described, because that's what most people experience when they're dead. They don't even know they're dead. So they're having one of the biggest experiences of their life and they miss it. I think it's kind of a shame. Be better to be lucidly dead than unlucidly dead. So I was thinking just this afternoon about the Tibetan term, there's a translation of shamatha. Shine, shine. Jeffrey Hopkins a long time ago translated that very literally as calm abiding, and that's become quite a standard translation. And he's an outstanding scholar, so of course it's not incorrect. It can be she means calm, peaceful, serene, tranquil. Ne means to abide, to be still, to be present. But it can be shiwaranepa, peacefully abiding. Some people translate it that way, peacefully abiding. Or the peacefully as an adverb could also be locative. It could be abiding in peace or rest in peace. So practice, practice, you know, 5,000 hours, 10,000 hours, and so you can finally rest in peace, lucidly. So if you have on your gravestone, R.I.P., that's quite a high praise. So to answer the question, I could go on and on and just on that one question, of course. It's a fascinating one. But if you die lucidly, you enter into the substrate consciousness lucidly, you know when you're there, then you're very well prepared for what comes next. You know, and what comes next is the clear light of death. If you've had some experience in Mahamudra or Dzogchen, shamatha is a superb preparation for that. Because if you're already lucid while you're just resting in the substrate consciousness, and then that breaks through and you slip into the clear light of death, you're very well prepared to enter into that lucidly And then you'll be like some of my teachers, like Genlam Rinpa, who abided in that clear light of death for more than 4 days, where all metabolic science had ceased, but there's no decomposition of the body. The body remains, you know, warmth at the heart, shining complexion, and so forth. A friend of mine was with him, Dr. Barry Curzon. So then you'll be one of those. And that happens about every year. There's at least one more yogi who dies in that and then blows the minds of the scientists because they have no idea how that can be possible. So, but if you pass through that lucidly, then you have a very good chance of passing through the bardo lucidly. To be in the bardo, this dreamlike phase, to be through passing through that, not deluded, not misapprehending it, not mistaking it for something else. In other words, being lucid in the bardo. And dream yoga is primarily a preparation for becoming lucid in the bardo, so you can make wise choices and direct your attention where you will in the bardo, and direct your attention to some worthwhile place to go for your next embodiment. And so if you're passing through all of that lucidly, then you may very well pass through the whole gestation period lucidly, be born lucidly, in which case you may be born with shamatha, which would be very cool. There is something called I think it's called Ngelki Dipa. Ngelki Dipa, the obscuration of the womb, of a birth by womb, that it said that just through that process of being born through the birthing canal, there is some kind of an obscuration, a veil that cloaks the mind for some time. But if you've achieved shamatha, then you may be temporarily cloaked. But it will be, once again, when you get back into the saddle, back into your practice, it should be quite easy to retrieve. So motivation, remember? Motivation. So that would be the answer to that. Okay? Hola, Sue. Let's just have a few comments. It's a lot of notes here, a lot of material. This psychiatrist, David Galen, is a man I know. He's a neuropsychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco. Wrote a very good paper years ago on the importance of metacognition for mental health and overall well-being. This quote's worth reading. It is, and it's from his paper. He states, it is more damaging to a person's integration. That's a nice word, integration, your wholeness, your sanity, your mental well-being and balance. I'm going to read a lot into that statement. But more damaging to a person's integration to be out of touch with the dimensions of personal reality, and that is what William James spoke about, the mind, your emotions, thoughts, desires, fantasies, memories, the whole world of your subjective experience. It is more damaging to a person's integration to be out of touch with the dimensions of personal reality through loss of self-monitoring, that is, to having an impaired metacognitive ability, than to be out of touch with the externals through sensory loss or paralysis. So he's saying for your personal integration, for mental health, well-being, balance, for flourishing, it's much more damaging to be metacognitively impaired than it is to be blind, deaf, or in a wheelchair. I think it's exactly right. I think it's literally true. I mean, I'm utterly persuaded that's true. Just this wonderful quote from William James, who had such insight into the significance of attention, the role of introspection, but specifically with regards to attention, he writes, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention, with which you're quite familiar by now, over and over again, is the very root of judgment, character, and will. So he's suggesting it has an enormous impact on your overall sense of well-being. And then he adds, an education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. But it is easier to define this ideal than to give practical instructions for bringing it about. So he was one of those individuals, I've studied his life, his writings fairly extensively with a lot of appreciation, and it seemed like he was simply naturally gifted, as some people are. Nikola Tesla, the great inventor, was another man. Incredible attention ability, imagination ability, working memory ability, astonishing. And that was crucial to his just almost inconceivable inventiveness, his creativity. William James in a different way, because his interest was not so much developing new technology as it was to understanding the nature of the mind. He had very good attention skills and outstanding introspection, but he was gifted. He was gifted with these abilities, and it really seems from his writings he didn't have a clue how to actually develop them. Right? So that's why he says if there were an education system that would educate students to develop their attention skills, that'd be fantastic. But he said, I don't know how. So he threw that out to the scientific community, And it fell on deaf ears for about a century. It's amazing. It's amazing. Something so important he made so clear. And then everybody fell asleep for a century. How strange. So the centrality of consciousness is something of paramount significance in the whole of the Buddhist tradition to understand the nature of consciousness. And in this regard, as one fathoms the nature of consciousness, fathoms a dimension of consciousness which is simply inaccessible, utterly inaccessible, if you're just studying the behavior and verbal reports of ordinary people, or you compound that with studying the brain, then you'll be the last to know. If there is a dimension of consciousness that is not contingent upon the brain, then people who are just studying behavior and the verbal reports of ordinary people and studying brain states, they'll be the last people to find out. You know, looking in the wrong place, they really will have, they'll be forever clueless. And the people who will know about multiple dimensions of consciousness, including dimension that carries on that is not contingent upon brain, that precedes the formation of this particular brain and continues on after this brain death, the people who will find that out the first will be the people who are actually looking at consciousness. I mean, it's just common sense. And so fathoming the nature of consciousness of crucial importance, breaking through the coarse mind to discover for oneself a dimension that does not begin with conception, does not end with death, enormously important. And it really can be scientifically studied, indirectly, but still, some very good science. So just mention four titles. For people on the podcast, like due to reading, I suggest nobody here do reading. We're here in such a precious environment. Don't waste the time by reading stuff outside. But I've mentioned a couple of titles. Ian Stevenson, Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. Summary of 40 years of research, and it was good research. There's one. And then Jim Tucker, now that Ian Stephen has passed away, Jim Tucker is a protege. I've met him. He's a very, very fine thinker. He's a medical doctor, sharp thinker, and really looking into this whole theme of children who allegedly have past life recall. He's studying it rigorously and wrote a very good book called Life Before Life. It's outstanding. Very rational, clear, no axe to grind, no dogma, no nothing. Just here's the evidence, let's make sense of it. So in terms of evidence that consciousness precedes this life, look at it. And then in terms of evidence, empirical evidence, scientific evidence, that there's a continuity, two books that really spring to mind, both quite recent and both really very good research. One is by a Dutch cardiologist by the name of, Pim van Lommel. Pim van Lommel. Done very good research, world famous, one of the top people in the field, and his most recent book is called Consciousness After Life. Consciousness After Life. I think that's it, yeah. And then it's just evidence of people continuing to have experiences after they're brain dead. And one of the most frequent contexts in which that takes place is when people have cardiac arrests. And then they're brain dead. Everything's shut down. And then when they're brought back because of the marvels of modern medicine, excellent technology, brilliant techniques to bring people back from the dead, finding they kept on having experiences after they were brain dead, you know? So there's one very good book. And then an even more recent one is by an American medical doctor by the name Sam Parnia, very recent book, and it's called Erasing Death. And he makes a very good point that a lot of the, discussions refer to near-death experiences, where people go brain dead, heart stops and so forth, they continue having experiences. And he's a medical doctor, works a lot with dead and dying people. And he said, it's an incorrect statement, near-death. It's post-death. These people are dead. It's completely shut down. The heart is shut down. The brain is shut down. Everything's shut down. And then, because of wonderful technology, medical technology, they are brought back. But they weren't near dead. They were really dead dead. And then being post-dead, they keep on having experiences. And he writes about them very critically, very astutely. So the evidence is there. Post-death experiences, including out-of-body experiences and so on. So a lot of people can be, the first response of many people is, cool. Or one also very recent book was by a neurologist that went brain dead. He had I think it was a disease, a very rare disease. He went brain dead. And while he was brain dead, he kept on having experiences. And his experiences were really heaven-like, paradisical experiences. He was kind of a namby-pamby Christian. That's who he described himself, kind of casual Sunday when I get to it, you know, if there's not a good football game. But he had these vivid experiences of heaven, and then they brought him back, of course, and then he wrote a whole book. Heaven exists. I saw it, you know. So the first response would be, wow, how cool. I've got past lives. I've got future lives. Wow, how cool. Until it kind of hits you, what exactly does that mean? And if I'm continuing, where am I going? And it's called samsara. And so by fathoming the nature of consciousness, continuity of consciousness, and then one sees evidence for past lives, implying probably there's evidence for future lives by implication, then that leads us to either we're living in a totally random, chaotic world where we have no control at all, we're just thrown around by random cosmic forces, or there's karma, which is to say that we're actually creating our future, which can then give rise to a yearning to be free of karma and free of this involuntary, helpless, being propelled, thrown from lifetime to lifetime. But it starts with consciousness and may culminate in a great aspiration to achieve liberation. And that's where the firmness is. You remember, once stability is achieved, let the mystery be revealed. Well, the stability there is a firm resolve for liberation. Or the Tibetan term is ngepar jungwa, definite emergence. A certainty, a resolve, a firmness, a definiteness is that I've had enough of samsara. I don't need any more colorful lives, thank you very much. I'd like to be free, liberated, and stabilized in that motivation. That's what those four thoughts of turning the mind are about. Develop a powerful, irreversible resolve, a stable resolve, hell or high water, however long it takes, this is it, you know, liberation. And then to complement that stability, that firmness of resolve, with attentional stability. As the Buddha said, one of the most commonly quoted statements is, someone whose mind is settled in meditative equipoise comes to know reality as it is. And in the first Bhavarakramana, I was just checking it out, he starts by saying, the mind flows like a river. It's never still unless you achieve shamatha. And the mind that is not still does not come to know reality as it is. But the Buddha said the mind established in meditative equipoise does come to know reality as it is. So it's coming to that stillness that we've already tasted, but being able to linger there in that stillness of awareness and then deepen. You know? So this is why this wildly and ridiculously overlooked theme of shamatha is so enormously important. And it's not any one school. It's not Zen versus Theravada, Theravada versus Indo-Tibetan. It's everywhere, and yet astonishing, so widely overlooked. How is that possible? I don't know. But push back the current. So I think wrapping up here. Yeah, just go. So we look at stability, and then he says, let the mystery be revealed. Well, what's the mystery? Something that is not clear now, but can become clear. It's a mystery until you throw back the cloak. You unveil it, and then it's no longer a mystery. And the mystery is, what's the nature of consciousness? What are the origins of consciousness? What's its role in nature? What happens to it at death? What's the nature of mind? What's the nature of mind? That's the mystery. And he said, if you'd like to fathom that mystery so that it's no longer a mystery, no longer cloaked in veils of ignorance and delusion, then first of all, achieve stability. Stability of resolve, stability of attention, or stillness of attention, stillness of awareness. And almost finished. Yeah, I think we will have time for the question and answer. But there's an American historian, one of the most eminent American historians by the name of Daniel Boorstin. He wrote a very long book, about 500 pages, called The Discoverers. The Discoverers. And he's very, very erudite. Wrote a 500-page book or so on the history of humanity's discoveries for the last 5,000 years or so, for recorded history. And he comments, having written the book, then he wrote his preface. I've written a lot of books. You often write the preface afterwards. I think he did as well. And he said, you know, surveying the history of humanity's discoveries, and he's covering everything. I mean, just what have human beings discovered in the last 5,000 years? But he writes in the preface that he said, surveying the last 5,000 years of histories in the East and West, scientific, geography, mind, cosmos, astronomy, and so forth and so on, what historically has proven to be the major obstacle to discovery is not ignorance. It's the illusion of knowledge. It's thinking you know something that you don't, in fact, know, and being very confident of it. That's the biggest obstacle. Because if you think you already know, then you'll have no incentive for actually investigating, because you already have the answer. But you're wrong. And I don't think there is any branch of science, or perhaps any branch of any modern field of knowledge, that is more cloaked with illusions of knowledge than the science of the mind. It's what, like wearing 10 overcoats of metaphysical baggage that's being presented as scientific fact. Like, the mind is what the brain does. This is a little song chirped throughout the entire scientific community and saturating all the press. The brain is the agent, the brain does this, the brain does that, the mind is just what the brain does, you're along for the ride, you're really nothing at all, you're just an epiphenomenon. So if you thought you were doing something, you're wrong. I just read a Nobel laureate, his name is Eric Kandel, it's published in the New York Times. He said, well, you know, if you get depressed, it's not your fault, you're not responsible for getting depressed. That sounds very nice. I don't want to be responsible for being depressed. Because it's a brain does it. If you get depressed, it's just because of brain function. All psychological problems are just brain functions. So from one perspective, you might feel, oh, that's kind of liberating. Good, then I'm not to blame, then I don't have to feel bad about myself. If I get depressed, it's just brain function. They just have to tell me what kind of chemicals to put into the brain to, you know, like an automobile engine, to restore the chemical balance. What he doesn't do is think twice or three times about it, apparently, that if I'm not responsible for getting depressed, I'm also not responsible for getting angry. I'm not responsible for getting hateful. I'm not responsible for being a racist. I'm not responsible for beating people when I get unhappy. I'm not responsible for engaging in ethnic cleansing. I'm not responsible for anything at all, because it's just the brain did it. And he's presenting that as a scientific fact. And he says, in so many words, the mind is what the brain does. The brain's doing it. So just everybody stand back, never mind your subjective experience. We neuroscientists, we will tell you not only about the nature of the mind, but we'll tell you who you are. As we gain more and more knowledge of the brain, because the brain is the actual agent, and not you. It's a catastrophic view by a Nobel laureate. And he's speaking the view of countless number of other people in the field. It's just compounding illusion upon illusion upon illusion of knowledge when they don't know what they're talking about. Because the simple fact is, scientists don't know the nature of the correlations between mind and brain. They know they're correlated, and that's all, but they don't know the nature of the correlation. Well, never mind that. Well, let's just say we do know. Let's just say that the brain produces all mental events, and now we know. It's just a product of the brain. So it's really catastrophic, the illusions of knowledge that saturate the brain sciences and a lot of the other aspects of mind science, I think, are really not only profoundly wrong, not only profoundly blocking any genuine discovery, but the implications are utterly catastrophic. They're completely dehumanizing, demoralizing, and disempowering to the individual, while empowering the people who are studying the brain because getting a whole lot of funding. And he said, although we haven't learned a lot about mental disease yet, just give us more money. We'll figure it out. Trust us. So I speak a lot of passion here because the damage is really catastrophic of these illusions of knowledge. If they can show that they actually know what they're talking about, good, show us the evidence. But they can't. It's just saying the same thing a lot. So we find something diametrically opposed. On this note, I will end. Dhammapada, first line, first verse of the Dhammapada, this compilation of aphorisms of the Buddha. All phenomena are preceded by the mind, issue forth from the mind, and consist of the mind. All phenomena being all experiences, all appearances, are preceded by the mind. To interpret that, from a Dzogchen perspective, the reference to the word mind here is a substrate consciousness. All the appearances that arise to our senses, the five senses, all appearances that arise in our dreams, appearances of mental events and so forth, these are all preceded by the substrate consciousness, which preceded the very formation of the mind that we have that arises independent upon the brain. But the substrate consciousness preceded that. So all experiences, all mental phenomena, thoughts, images, emotions, dreams, and so forth, they're all preceded by the substrate consciousness. They issue forth from the substrate consciousness. They don't issue forth from neurons or glial cells or bone marrow or anything else. They don't issue forth from chemicals or electricity. Anybody who studies electricity and chemicals should know that they just don't have it in them to give rise to emotions. It's really a very silly thought. It's a very widely spread illusion of knowledge. So all phenomena are issue forth from the mind, and they consist of the mind. And that is, all the appearances that arise are really formations of that very space of the mind itself, illuminated by consciousness. So that's the Buddhist view. Going right back to the Dhammapada, runs through all schools of Buddhism. Not mind only. We don't have to say, oh, that's mind-only school. That's one school. But this is much deeper than that. And it's not making an ontological claim about reality as a whole here in the Dhammapada. It's just saying, for all appearances, where are they coming from? They're not coming from the object. They're not coming emerging out of the brain. They're coming from substrate consciousness, or bhavanga, if you like, from the Pali Canon. Then it's another statement, even more powerful, from a Mahayana Sutra, the Ratnamegha Sutra. All phenomena are preceded by the mind. Okay, we've heard that one before. But then he says, when the mind is comprehended, all phenomena are comprehended. It's from the inside out. And then he concludes, by bringing the mind under control, all things are brought under control. So we can see this is an absolute head-on collision. Somebody's flamboyantly wrong. And it could be the Buddhist, or it could be the materialist. But they can't both be right. Because if we turn this on its head, here's what you will find in virtually any textbook on neuroscience. All experiences are preceded by the brain. They issue forth from the brain, and they consist of brain functions. That's virtually an unquestioned series of statements. I've never seen it questioned. So is the brain primary or substrate consciousness primary? Something's primary, something's not. Somebody's really wrong. So when a very fine, really world-class neuroscientist by the name of Wolf Zinger, German neuroscientist, he's retired now, but really world-class. I met him just briefly, I don't really know him, but Matthieu Ricard knows him very well. They've actually written a book together. Matthieu Ricard took him up to Tushi Rinpoche. Tushi Rinpoche's monastery up in the Himalayas. So adventurous elderly neuroscience went up there. It's not an easy trek. And what Matthieu told me was that Matthieu, serving as interpreter, one monk after another came to this neuroscientist, everybody knowing he's a materialist, because they pretty much all are, with a few exceptions here and there, like stars in the daytime, as they say. And one monk came up after another to speak with this great professor, this great neuroscientist, and describing either their own or other people's experience of paranormal experience, clairvoyant, insight into deeper states of consciousness, just one experience after another that completely refuted or demolished any kind of materialistic beliefs. And they kind of just basically battered. It was like a gang bang of insights assailing the fortress of metaphysical belief in materialism. And he listened to it all, to his great credit. I'm not criticizing him at all. To his great credit, he went up there and he listened. And what Matthieu reported to me was, after he heard all of this, his response was, either they're wrong or we're fundamentally wrong. It's a good, fair statement. A fair statement. Okay? But somebody's really wrong here. So how do you find out? Well, Denpa Thobne Sangwet Deng. Achieve stability, and let the mystery be revealed. And we'll go directly from that to ultimate bodhicitta. So he's going to take you right into the deep end of the pool very, very quickly. None of this gradual lum rim, gradually step, small scope, medium scope, and then coming to the very end, getting to the teachings on emptiness. Now he's going to give it to you right up front. Like going into a bar and say, barkeep, give me your best stuff right now. The stuff you keep in the back room. Hit me. That's what he does here. Questions or comments? Tomorrow we'll go into ultimate bodhicitta, so bring your seatbelts tomorrow. Any questions or comments today? Or should we have a 5-minute early break? Yes, please. Acha, thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Lisette, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I'm looking carefully. Okay, which one? Which one? Lizette, gotcha. The light hair is Lizette, by the way.
Okay.
Here it comes.
It's coming. Thank you very much. Thank you. When in the field of the mind, a thought comes, do you either grasp it nor reject it, isn't it?
That is correct.
Okay. How do I know when unconsciously that thought, I'm constructing it?
If you're unconsciously constructing it, you can't know it, by definition. Because if it's unconscious, then you're not knowing it. Right? But I'm going to just rephrase the question, because it's a very good question. And that is, how do we know? So you remember the aphorism, maintain the flow of mindfulness, ma ying zimet, without distraction. And that we know what that is, being carried away, right? But also, and so that's a bit binary. So if I'm attending to your face, am I right now? And then you watch my eyes go over to Jude, over to Carmen, over to that guy there. Then you can see, oh, he's distracted. He's distracted. I'm either on your face or not, right? That's distraction. So I'm either distracted or not. It's fairly binary, yes or no. Grasping, it's not yes or no. It's not a sheer, nice, clean cut, I am or I am not, because it's such a smooth gradient. So if we try to make simply a decision, all right, I'm going to sit here and I'm just not going to grasp at all, that's a tough one to carry out, okay? So we can see there's a whole spectrum here, a gradient of grasping, from benign to malignant, okay? So grasping can be with a great deal of craving and attachment. A husband who is ferociously jealous of his wife, you know, doesn't let her out of the house. He doesn't want any man to see her. Maybe puts a bag over her head so nobody can see it and so forth. Or over the whole body for that matter. You know, really kind of insanely jealous. That's really intense grasping, right? Jealous husband. Totally constricting her, denying any kind of freedom because he's afraid that maybe, you know, she'll be drawn to somebody else. So that's really coarse, malignant grasping, right? Very obvious. Or grasping with hatred, when we really grasp onto, this person is the cause of all my suffering. That's intense grasping. So we have that out at the pole, at an extreme, right? But then I've already participated in the kind of grasping right at the beginning of the conversation. I said, I remember, you're Lizette. That right there, that designation, you're Lizette, that is a type of grasping. I've just now locked on, I've isolated you from your environment, Lizette and not Lizette, and really not Lizette, and not even close, you know? I mean, just and not close at all. So I've demarcated you from everything that's not Lizette, and I've made sharp contours. Yes, 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 but absolutely not. Yes, 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 no. You know, sharp contour, totally decontextualize you by just simply saying, that's Lizette right there. I've now carved you out of the whole fabric of your environment, the causal nexus that's giving rise to you from moment to moment, the influences you're having on the environment from moment to moment. And with this cookie cutter of my mind, the conceptual mind, Lizette is right there. Boom. That's grasping. Because I've carved you out just by labeling you. There's Lizette, and the rest of the universe is not Lizette. Right? So, but that's not malignant. Just identifying you as Lizette is not giving rise to mental afflictions. It doesn't necessarily imply a reification, but it is a type of grasping. So now, but that's benign. So that's benign. Or my teacher is Gyatso Rinpoche. One of my teachers is Gyatso Rinpoche. That's grasping. I've now isolated him, you know, that person. So there's benign grasping, and then there's afflictive grasping, and then there's really, really malignant grasping that causes wars and ethnic cleansing and all that kind of thing. So in this practice of settling the mind, through a process of just an ongoing deepening of relaxation, of letting go, of releasing, of releasing, of releasing, and that does not mean banishing. It just means releasing the grasping through this softening, this melting, this lightness, you know, without getting dull, vague, spaced out. Then as we relax more and more deeply into it while maintaining the clarity with which we illuminate the space of the mind, then grasping subsides. Okay? Now, let's just give one example. We're almost out of time, but this is very, very practical. And that is when thoughts come up. Somebody in a interview with me today said, what do I do with the commentary? When I'm settling the mind in its natural state, I'm getting this commentary going on and on and on. I really like it to stop, right? And for this practice, the goal is not to get the commentary to stop. because your aversion to the commentary is a type of grasping. The commentary is a mental event. It's discursive thoughts. Now, if we're grasping onto identifying with them, if we have the sense, I am the commentator, and I'm thinking this, then that's grasping, right? And so, as we're resting there, loose, awareness just open, illuminated space of the mind, whatever thoughts come up, including the commentary, just let it be. And that's the movement of the mind, and see if you can remain in the stillness of your awareness and illuminate the commentary without being caught up and carried away by it, without grasping onto it, without trying to perpetuate it, and without trying to terminate it. So you're actually, even for the commentary itself, trying to be as loose, as free, just letting it be, and not even being averse to that. That's why this point, in this practice, the practice is not even to prefer silence, not even to prefer no thought versus thought, but release all preference. So just like space, if you imagine just being an expanse of space, and the space is just there, whether it's a comet coming through, or a hummingbird, or dirt, you know, dust, whatever, smog, space doesn't care. It just is the domain in which these events are taking place, right? So this is why the classic instructions in this practice said, let your body be as still as a mountain, so as much as possible, not fidgeting, moving about, and so forth, because that draws you right into the body with identification and grasping. So as much as possible, just let it be, the body still, and let your body still like a mountain, but awareness still like space, unmoved even by the internal commentary. And even when thoughts do come up, just being present with them. But when you see that movement, when you see the movement of your own awareness, that's when you know grasping is taking place, right? And then, so that could be pretty benign, you know, going out, oh, what's that noise, or what's that? Pretty benign, but it is still, you've been thrown off your throne. You know, awareness is moved from its own place, let alone when some rumination comes in of some really kind of, with a lot of vortex, a lot of pulling power, a lot of compulsive quality, and it draws you in, sucks you in, and you're now attending to the referent of the thought. Maybe some rumination, some resentment, some craving, some anxiety, and you're attending to what you're anxious about, or you're angry at, and so forth. That's when it's gotten toxic. And at that point, once again, it's subtle, in that it's not to banish the thought. It's not to banish the thought. It's to release your grasping onto the thought. So the thought can carry on by itself, but without carrying you with it, right? So when you see that you're carried away by the thought, the idea, the response is not to release the thought, like, go away. It's not that. It's rather just releasing your clinging onto it. And if the thought continues or not, you just observe it. Just observe it, okay? So I'll give an analogy. If you were here, I would call from your finger, but I'm going to imagine this is your finger, okay? This one, just imagine that one's yours. And so this, imagine this is my mind. And you're a distracting thought, okay? So you got to be persona, grasping thought personified. And so here's my mind, and this grasping thought called Lizette comes in and grabs my mind. And then, you know what these ruminating thoughts do? They jerk me all around, you know? And I really don't like that. And I'm saying, whoa, I really don't like this rumination. This wandering mind's driving me crazy. Until I suddenly thought, maybe I need to do something about that. And she's just jerking me around. It's really awful, right? Shame on you. Until I suddenly recognize, wait a minute, I think she's not just jerking me around. I think I'm actually participating in this. I think I need to do something. Oh, I know. That's what allowed you to jerk me around. That it wasn't just the advent, the occurrence of some wandering thought, the hook. It needs to meet another hook. And then I get jerked all around, and I suffer. It's a little samsara, right? But as soon as I release, then you can continue or not, but I simply observe, and then I'm free. So that's what we do. It's just enough effort to release the grasping onto the thought without getting a sledgehammer come out and saying, bad thought. You know? Because what the bad thought will do is, bad mind. And they went, no, you're bad. No, you're bad. You're bad. You're bad. And then we have vicious cycle. So just releasing grasping, that's really the core. You're welcome. Oh, Lasso. Is that enough for one afternoon? Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning.